gentlemen, program cards for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium. Thank you.
Good evening, Raymond.
Tomas, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, sir.
Good.
Another Benjamin Britten evening.
Big on Britten, what? They were not lying when they said big on Britten.
They certainly were not. I think week upon week of big on Britten at this stage. But a fabulous evening for the season that's in it.
For the season that's in it, exactly. And also, Tomas, for the anorak fact, I've come up with another one. You had a 50 pence piece there the last time we were talking about Britten. Look what I've brought for you.
Let's have a look.
Hold on, see if you can get it off here. This is an iPhone cover, Tomas, with a silhouette of Benjamin Britten. Picked it up in the Barbican last week, where they're now available. And I was just thinking, Tomas, if we were able to have, by some sort of miracle, a 100th birthday party, and we got Britten alive, he made a Lazarus-like appearance at the party, you could bump into him and show him the 50 pence piece. Tell him he's on the 50 pence piece, and he would know precisely what you're talking about. No further explanation necessary. If I then met him and told him, hey, you're on the iPhone cover, if I was even able to show it to him and show him the phone and all the rest of it, he wouldn't have the faintest notion what I was talking about. And just think of the number of stages since he died in 1976 and how quickly things are passing. Just think of the number of stages of explanation that I would need to bring him up to speed on that, whereas the 50 pence piece coin, which has only changed, I think, in weight and shape since then, he would need no explanation. I mean, for instance, Tomas, was the mobile phone even a twinkle in anybody's eye in 76?
The mobile phone did exist, not in its exact form that we have today, where it's ubiquitously in everybody's hands, and I see quite a lot of people around here staring into their phones, but it would have been understood only by people in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years in the way that we now use it. And I think that's the brilliance of music, and you compare that to technology. We'd have to go and explain to a genius like Britten, we'd have to explain this to him. But we wouldn't have to explain music, nor would we have to explain music in 100 years' time by Benjamin Britten. I suppose the crux of the big on Britten thing is, would people be interested in the explanation of Benjamin Britten in 100 years' time? Is he going to survive as an important musician? Is he going to survive as an important composer in 100 years' time? And that's the thing with music. Because of its longevity, it's about assessing it on this kind of regular basis. So here's the 100th. We're kicking off for an assessment of it. We don't have to worry about assessing the mobile phone. Everyone's using it now. There'll be something completely different in 5, 10 years' time.
Well, Tomas, the man who'll back you up in your assertion there is our cellist here this evening, Peter.
It's Whispelway. Said like it's like spelt, but it is a Dutch name.
Oh, I see. But what I was saying was that he would back up your contention about Britten's music lasting. And this is the ultimate test, I suppose, for a work of art. Will it last? Will it speak across the generations and not just speak to the people who were alive when it was written? Whispley has said, with specific respect to the cello symphony this evening, that Britten's music will last. And I think perhaps that we're seeing a good example of programming here this evening, Tomas, is that the soiree musicale, perhaps they won't last. It's a light, flippant little 10-minute piece, but there's no doubt about it, the darker, stronger, deeper qualities of the cello symphony will last, because they will continue to speak across the ages.
And St. Nicholas?
Oh, I love him. He's yet to come.
Well, actually, I think the programming this evening is quite perfect for that question. In 100 years, when we look back at works like the soiree musicale, like the symphony, the cello symphony, and like the St. Nicholas piece still to come this evening, this is going to be an assessment. We've got to assess these away from why they were written. And we're already there. I mean, even now, you're wondering, well, why has Benjamin written something about St. Nicholas? What was that about? What was the cello symphony about? And we're abstracting from the reasons why it was done. And those are drifting off into history. And eventually the music will come to the foreground away from the history. But for us and for me, and when I listen to it tonight, I'm still thinking of all the history. And then you ask yourself, why St. Nicholas? And when you dig into it, the reason for it is hugely interesting.
Let me be the judge of that tomorrow.
Okay. Game on. Right. Well, the reason why is because his long-term partner, Peter Pears, had gone to Lansing College, which was an independent school, which is a public school, what we call an English public school in England, of course. And so it's this is, and it's quite a very august one. It was on its having its 100th anniversary in 1948. So push came to shove, and somehow, of course, they managed to twist the arm of Benjamin Britten to write a piece for them. But we're doing this in 1948. And so it's a time of great austerity, so that's going to play a little part in it as well. But why St. Nicholas? So you go to the college, you find out about it, and it turns out that they have a chapel which has the largest rose window in England, completed in 1976, is the year of his death, of Benjamin Britten's death, in fact. And then you find that the college's chapel is called St. Mary and St. Nicholas. So then it becomes a little more evident why the thing was St. Nicholas. So then he asks his good friend, Eric Crozier, to go off and do some research for the libretto. And he goes off, and he and Benjamin Britten then fashion this beautiful piece. But of course, it's responding to what's going on around them in 47, 48, in exactly the same ways for George Orwell, who George Orwell is writing 1984 about 1948. So it's about rationing, it's about austerity, it's about this huge big brother state, it's about lack of respect for authority because you're wondering how this authority is going. And what you have in St. Nicholas is a man who's appointed Bishop of Myra and essentially is railing against authority, and he's protecting children, and he's looking out for the small people within this rather harsh world, this austere world.
You mentioned rationing there, Tomás. I got to add something for you there. It's really important, looking from this remove back to 1948, just to understand how difficult things were, particularly in Britain at the time. 3 years after the war, rationing was still very much in place. Not only that, you mentioned, of course, dare I say, geopolitical world. I mean, they were living under the threat then of the atom bomb. No one really knew what was going to happen at that stage. It was a very serious threat. The Cold War, the Iron Curtain, as Churchill named it, had come down across Europe. But on a day-to-day business as well, life was a bit grim and grey. Let me tell you a little story. I wrote the history there many years ago of the boat club in Trinity. They used to go over to compete at Henley every year. And in the first post-war Henley, they took not only a set of oars and everything with them, but serious trunkloads of food so as to make sure that they'd be well fed. Move on another year or two after that, and I found correspondence between the Trinity Boat Club and Oxford and Cambridge, the crews training for the boat race every year, requesting that Trinity would send meat packages, food packages, over to both of the crews so that they would be well fed for the forthcoming race. And of course the question is, did they send over some fillet steak? Why am I talking about fillet steak? Because the first piece of music this evening was of course based on Rossini, and of course named after Rossini, as a good trencherman myself I would know this, is Tornado Rossini. Luxury dish, absolutely gorgeous. And you say, well, why did they name it after him? Well, he was a noted gourmet and gourmand trencherman, shall we say. He was noted, and apparently the story goes that having composed his final opera, he put his pen down with a flourish, and for the remaining years of his life, he devoted himself solely to the pleasures of the table, and hence went for Tornado Rossini. But Tomás, staying within Italy, he's one of the pillars of Italian opera. If we were to go with a wine with Tornado Rossini, any thoughts?
Nice Sassicaia would be good, a good meaty wine, plenty of tannin, break that down. I think I'd go for 2 glasses of that now.
Am I allowed a counterpunch? You see, I think some of these Sassicaia would fit into that maybe sort of super Tuscan mould. I would be thinking more of the moral high ground of Barolo. Right. That would be the one for me, a great Barolo to go with that dish, and I would set it off beautifully.
Well, I don't know if I'd agree that it's quite so august, the Barolo. And I think that the Sassicaia, which is it's more technical, it's a less puritanical wine. And I think it's the kind of thing that'd be more generous with a nice fillet steak.
Oh, let me come back now, Tomás. Hold on a second there. I said we've got to go something first that's quintessentially Italian. You see, I'm not sure that... I think Sassicaia was made with a view to appealing to a broad international audience, whereas I really feel with the Barolo, which is made from the Nebbiolo grape, a difficult, tough old grape, but it can taste like drinking barbed wire if it's not right. But when it is right, it's the most gorgeous wine you can imagine, and is quintessentially Italian. There's really nowhere in the world can rival a great Nebbiolo from Barolo. I mean, Nebbiolo is grown in other places around the world, but it's a difficult grape, and as a consequence, I think it really reaches its apogee there and is quintessentially Italian as a result. Whereas Sassicaia tastes to me very good, very impressive, but what I call international.
But then, you see, the Sassicaia is perfect for the Soirée Musicale. You see, because it's after Rossini. It's not saying it's Italian. It's stylistically after Italian, but it has that international feel. I think I have you there, Raymond.
But Tomas, you said it would go well with the Soirée Musicale. I'm putting it with Turnadore Rossini, not with the music.
Oh, dearie me.
You'll have noted, Tomas, that, you know, the lovely light little bit of candy floss we had the first 10-minute piece, and then we got into the cello symphony, a much darker, deeper, stronger piece of music. That's going to be one of the pieces of music of Britain's that lasts. I think it was specifically composed with Rostropovich in mind.
The symphony, the cello symphony here by Benjamin Britten, is all about the great Cold War divide. This was 1963, 1964 had its premiere in March 1964, which of course was, just I'm sure you know, was the same week and day, in fact, that they were cranking up filming A Hard Day's Night. They were still getting over generally throughout the world the death and the assassination of Kennedy just 4 months before, in November 63. Into this milieu comes Rostropovich. Benjamin Britten had been touring the Western nations of Europe, upholding the great tradition of the West and keeping our allies right there on the Cold War at the newly built Berlin Wall, keeping them all happy and satisfied with the cultural superiority of the West. And into this comes a little flower of peace, and that is Rostropovich and his wife, who come over and they do a little tour, possibly doing their little Soviet tour, showing that they're also had a cultural background, also had some cultural superiority to press ahead with. But then what they couldn't have expected, and this is the genius of music, is that Benjamin Britten and Rostropovich meet and get together and create something new and brilliant, a signal of something to come. Towards the end of this performance, St. Nicholas arrives at an inn where he finds that there are travellers and they're about to have a nice tasty bit of meat. But he realises and sees that the evil inn owner has actually pickled boys and he's about to serve them pickled, sliced and diced boys. So he sings and he calls out to the children and he has them rise up, and they rise up and they reclothe themselves in their garments, their worldly garments, they're reborn.
I'm getting a strong visual here.
Right, oh, absolutely. It's a very powerful image. And it's about, we can read it in many ways, it's all about reclothing the people after the war. And, of course, austerity was going through his mind and rationing and all these other things are out there as well. And he's bringing people back to their fullness. So, in all this, of course, there's plenty of tunes and there are hymns. And, in fact, it ends with a fantastic hymn, God moves in mysterious ways.
And that comes back to us full circle to what you said earlier there about the, not just the power of music but the timelessness of it. It'll cross all borders. It'll cross borders today, national, international borders, and then cross borders over the generations as well.
Yes, because in 100 years' time, people are not even going to understand the Cold War. It's hard to explain to somebody who's 15 or 20 years of age what the Soviet Union was and how the threat that was hanging over was real and how this huge division between the West and the Soviet Union was there. And here was Benjamin Britten creating this beautiful, moody, dark piece out of it. In 100 years' time, it'll be just thought of as a soulful, moody, dark piece, but it was about, and it came out of and emerged from its own moment.
Did I ever tell you, Tomas, about the time I was coming home from, where was it? I think it was in China or somewhere like this. And there was a cellist on the plane. And, of course, he had booked two seats. Obviously, it was a British Airways flight, I remember well. And on he got, and he had the seat for the cello and a seat for himself beside it. And he strapped the cello in and everything, you see. But then one of the hostesses came along and had a look at it and said, no, that's not good enough. And some like engineer-type mechanic came onto the plane and spent one hour, securing that cello until he was absolutely satisfied that it was in the right place and was not going to move or the rest of it. So that musicians of this sort, they face great difficulties carrying these instruments. Even violinists now are finding that Previously, most airlines would always allow them just put it into the overhead locker. A number of airlines are now insisting on booking a seat. Not only that, it has to be a window seat, because if it's an emergency exit, it has to be in the window seat. So if you've got, say, a couple travelling, one of them is a violinist, they need to... There are some airlines where you have to barge on because you can't secure your seat in advance. You've got to find three seats together, and the violin has to go inside on the inside one. I can see you're about to tell me I'm drifting.
No, I'm about to tell you you're right on the money. But of course, Ryanair is now a loving airline, and happiness and joy is going to be their new.
How did you know I'm with Ryanair? I never mentioned
customer service is where they're at. So I think they're going to welcome cellos with open arms.
I wait to see the day.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. All doors are now closing. Thank you.